This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Cedarside. Cedarside's original 100% organic insect spray kills bed bugs, mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, mites, scorpions, roaches, and more, but is completely safe for your home, pets, and family. Go to cedarside.com, use coupon code Hoffman at checkout for free shipping, or call 800-842-1464 and mention you heard it here.
Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and it is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. And the way that you get us questions is by emailing us to radioprogram@AOL.com. We'll do our best to answer as many questions as we can, if they're suitable, if they're of sufficient brevity and relevant to our listeners' concerns. How are you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
Good. For many of our listeners, very familiar with you. But for our newbies, Layla Mutin is Hoffman Center nutritionist, and she is also a registered dietitian and has obtained a master's degree in the field of nutrition. So how are you doing as the summer proceeds here?
As the summer proceeds, yeah, already August, huh?
As the world turns.
Yeah.
Right. So, but, you know, it's been a good summer. I'm feeling good. Doing a lot of good stuff, outdoor stuff, and took advantage of the little cooler temperatures this morning to take a nice run outside. I mean, running in the summer, you got to get up really early. Or else,
yep,
you got to wait for like a little bit
of what
can be termed a cold snap, which means that the humidity goes under about 60% and the temperature goes below 85. Yeah, that's a cold snap here in New York in the summer. But we had some, nice refreshing air this morning, so I decided to get out there and do my morning run by the beautiful East River. Which is kind of a nice way to get away from the hustle bustle of Manhattan. There's a nice, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but there's a running path beside the East River that I can access via the what is now called the Ed Koch Bridge, but New Yorkers refer to it as...
Oh, I don't call it the Ed Koch Bridge.
It's the 59th Street Bridge. Yeah.
That's going to take a long time.
That's right. You know,
for me to think of it as the Ed Koch Bridge.
No, it's going to take... Yeah. Right. And the... Robert Kennedy,
RFK,
Kennedy,
yeah,
RFK
it's
Bridge.
Always going to be the Triborough to me.
Definitely the Triborough, right. Anyway, and our office is on Avenue of the Americas. No, it isn't. It's on 6th Avenue. So anyway, all right.
Right.
So we got a bunch of questions, so let's proceed with our questions. By the way, and we're very delighted that many of you are availing yourselves of the opportunity to pose questions. And what may happen is if you send us a question, please keep listening to our weekly Q&A with Layla, because eventually you're likely to turn up. And it may be, we have about a two-week delay, I think.
Sometimes 3.5 weeks. So just hang in there and keep listening.
Right. Great.
Yeah.
So let's, without further ado, let's answer as many questions as we can.
Okay. We have a question from Christine. Hi, Dr. H and Layla. 4 months ago, I had the awful experience of a kidney stone. That was an ER visit. The kind of stone was never determined, and this came out of the blue. I'm an otherwise healthy 61-year-old female with no family history. Maybe I wasn't drinking enough water, so I started monitoring that. This week, I got some follow-up blood work, which showed a urea nitrogen creatinine of 22. I guess the ratio.
That's the ratio, yeah. And by the way, so that is actually a ratio that is a pretty good indicator of degree of hydration.
Yes.
And so when the creatinine is okay, that means that your kidneys are okay. But when the BUN accumulates, BUN is the waste products of protein digestion and metabolism. And so when you have, say, a BUN of 1 and you have a creatinine of 33 or something, that suggests that you're kind of on the dehydrated side. And we'll see that sometimes people restrict their fluid intake. Sometimes people on diuretics will see that as well.
Yeah.
So what did she say? It was 22?
Yeah, it was 22.
It could be better.
Yeah, it could be better.
Yep.
And, you know, in summertime, people are more dehydrated.
Sure, and that's
so that could
a prime time for stones, a prime time for stones.
It is. There is more prevalence in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
So she's wondering, what should I take? Does alpha-lipoic acid work? Is this an indication of compromised kidneys? Help.
Okay, well, you know, I actually wrote a pretty comprehensive article on this probably last year. And if you go to the search box at drhoffman.com, you can Google kidney stones, or the more formal name for it, nephrolithiasis, but probably be under kidney stones, and you'll see the article in its entirety. But you and I pretty much know what to tell this listener.
Yeah. Most kidney stones are oxalate, calcium oxalate stones, even though Christine tells us the type of stone was not determined. So we could probably assume it was that type of a stone.
That's reasonable.
So typically we would put Christine on a low oxalate diet, number one. Number two, it's imperative that she take some magnesium citrate to help keep the calcium from crystallizing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the citrate,
so
higher levels
helpful.
Of citrate, which comes from either magnesium citrate, or there's a drug called polycitra, which is potassium citrate, which the urologists and kidney specialists prefer. But I like magnesium citrate because I think magnesium is a useful mineral to put into the body. And it's really about getting your citrate levels up. Now, citrate is citric acid. And therefore, drinking lemonade is a good idea, but not sugary lemonade, because there's actually some studies that suggest that high intake of sugar predisposes to stones as well. So unsweetened lemonade, that's kind of tart.
lemon water.
Right, but lemon water, you know, just drink a lot of lemon water, you know, squeeze some lemons, and, you know, if you want to sweeten that a little bit with some stevia, maybe, you know, okay.
Dr. Hoffman, I've seen a couple of clients just recently with kidney stones, and their doctors, their internists, have put them on a calcium citrate supplement. Mm-hmm. What do you say to that?
Well, that's interesting, because I was just about to say, okay, well, we're restricting oxalate. These are calcium oxalate stones, so it would stand to reason that too much calcium could cause stones.
Yeah.
But only rarely, and there was a situation that used to occur before they had modern acid-blocking medications is, you know, this typical, you know, like in Mad Men, you know, the TV show, the typical Madison Avenue executive was very, very stressed. You know, the dashing commuter, the man in the gray flannel suit, and they didn't have effective acid blockers then. So these guys could get ulcers, and how would they treat their ulcers? Well, they would chew on, you know, the equivalent of Tums, calcium carbonate lozenges, and they would keep a bottle of milk in their drawer because milk was said to be soothing for ulcers. Well, what they developed was something called milk alkali syndrome because they consumed enormous amounts of calcium, and they alkalinized their body with the antacids, and that could lead to stones. But ordinary amounts of calcium, you know, the amount that we prescribe for osteoporosis, should not cause that. So, you know, it's really interesting that it's more about the oxalate and about hydration and other cofactors than it is about calcium intake when it comes to these stones, which are in part calcium.
Yeah. Another thing I hypothesize anyway is that so many people are walking around with magnesium deficiency. If more people had enough magnesium in their bodies, maybe they wouldn't make so many stones.
Right. There's something to that because magnesium is sort of a calcium antagonist. Another thing that predisposes to stones is if you have some sort of severe diarrhea or steatorrhea, which is like fat malabsorption, and that can occur often in patients with inflammatory bowel disease. They are more likely to get stones. So that, you know, something to look out for as a risk factor. Also, B6 has been shown to be helpful at preventing calcium oxalate stones. So I would give, you know, maybe 100 or 200 milligrams of B6 daily as a preventive. And hydrate. Now, there's certain things that you hydrate with that may not be so good because they contain oxalic acid. Like you drink a lot of tea, maybe not so good. Tea is high in oxalic acid. Also, cranberry juice, although good for the urinary tract, for urinary tract infections, if you guzzle a lot of cranberry juice, that's going to be fairly high in oxalate. So good for infections, maybe not for stones. Sometimes stones are accompanied infections. So that could potentially be a problem. Excess sodium has been associated in some cases with stone formation, dietary sodium.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. That's interesting.
So there's, I think stones are preventable using some of these methods. And then we can sometimes do what's called a stone risk profile. We can actually analyze the urine to see if the urine is sufficiently diluted and to see if there's high enough levels of citrate to prevent stones or if there's too high levels of oxalate or too high levels of calcium. So that's how we would maybe follow a patient like that.
All right. Best of luck to you, Christine.
Indeed.
Okay, Our next question comes from Linda. Linda suffers from dyshidriotic eczema.
Mm-hmm.
She developed this on her thumb.
Do you know what that is?
It means dyshidrosis.
I think it means either too much or too little sweating. And I guess in this case, there's patients who suffer from hyperhidrosis, excess sweating. But I'm not sure what dyshidrosis means in this case. Probably excess sweating, creating the predisposition to eczema.
Okay. She developed this on her thumb. In the winter, she was under a lot of stress. She was given Cipro and steroid cream, although she refused to take prednisone.
Cipro. Yeah. Oral Cipro?
Yeah, oral
Cipro.
That's
just a nasty drug. And, we really are reluctant to see patients taking Cipro because a small but significant percentage of patients develop something called FQ syndrome, fluoroquinolone syndrome. They become floxed, and it's devastating. So I would really use Cipro as a last resort. I guess they think there may be an infectious component to this.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Or that's like a fungal component. I guess the area that's chronically moist might be susceptible to infection. Is that maybe what they're thinking?
Maybe, because it's on her thumb.
Yeah. Okay. On her thumb. Right. Oh, that's a weird place.
Okay. Yeah. Very weird.
Okay.
Yeah. Medical management, right?
I think we would want to use some of the same principles that we apply to ordinary eczema, which is look for food precipitants, make sure the diet's low in sugar, look at the yeast connection, because sometimes systemic yeast is an issue and we want a low sugar diet, and avoid yeast products. And also
maybe taking olive leaf or regicillin.
Yeah, these are natural antifungals, or perhaps even a systemic antifungal. I give patients a prescription sometimes for nystatin, Nizoral, Diflucan. These are medications that sometimes break the cycle of fungal infection, which could be a contributory factor there. Did I recall you saying that she was taking antifungal creams or oral medication?
A steroid cream.
Oh, steroid cream. Okay, well, that's
steroid cream.
That's a that's a classic move in dermatology. I think dermatology is a fascinating field, but there's kind of a limited number of things you can do in dermatology. You can give an antifungal. You can give a steroid cream. you can biopsy it and send it off, or you can use an antibiotic. And there's some newer drugs that are sort of immunosuppressive medications that you apply to the skin or take orally. I really like approaching dermatological problems from a more holistic standpoint.
Yeah, and a more systemic standpoint, because we got to look at the gut.
Yeah.
Typically, yeah. Oh, best of luck to Linda. All right. Let's see here. We've got a question from Elaine. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, thank you for sharing your wealth of knowledge with us all. My physical therapist believes I would benefit from visceral manipulation. Based on an MRI and a physical evaluation, I have intermittent aches and pains that travel from one place to another. Sometimes it's severe, sometimes it's dull. Tests were negative for Lyme disease. There's no rheumatoid arthritis. What are your thoughts on visceral manipulation? I did look this up.
Okay. Because I'm going to confess, that I have very little familiarity with this approach.
Yeah. Well, the viscera, for our listeners, refer to the internal organs of the body, And this is from the Barrel Institute that I'm reading off of. The internal organs of the body, such as the liver, kidneys, intestines, and visceral manipulation is a gentle manual therapy that aids your body's ability to release restrictions and unhealthy compensations that can cause pain. So VM does not focus solely on the site of pain or dysfunction, but evaluates the entire body to find the source of the problem. The VM therapist feels for altered or decreased motion within the viscera, as well as restrictive patterns throughout the body, and then applies the VM techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And this can help reestablish the body's ability to adapt and restore itself to health.
Okay.
It's very interesting.
It sounds interesting, and it is along the lines of chiropractic and acupuncture, which
mm-hmm.
Look at energy flow within the body and, maybe search for trouble spots that are, sort of an indirect way of dealing with pain. Pain in your shoulder might be referred, say, from your diaphragm, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And we know this to be the case, is that, for example, patients who have pancreatitis, they sometimes complain of terrible back pain. Or patients who have a gallbladder problem, they may complain of their pain. They have pain in the right shoulder. Or patients having a heart attack may have pain down their arm. So we know that the internal organs, there can be referred pain from the internal organs to other parts of the body. The pain of a kidney stone is sometimes referred down the leg or into the genital area. I guess there's something to it, at least theoretically. And, therapies like this are only as good as they work. If,
right.
do a series of treatments and you feel that this is a healing path, more power to you because you have an elusive problem. And, what does conventional medicine do with this kind of thing? Well, you might take something like a fibromyalgia medication like, Lyrica or Neurontin to deaden the pain. But then you feel, mentally dull and tired and gorked out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not that's an inferior way of dealing with this.
And, if her physical therapist believes that Elaine would benefit from it, all the more power. I love physical therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've had wonderful physical therapy experiences myself, both with carpal tunnel syndrome. I've had physical therapy on my feet when I had bilateral bunionectomy way mm-hmm. back when. I think physical therapy is absolutely wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So, more power. More power to Elaine.
All right. Yeah. Well,
okay.
And Elaine promised to give us some feedback on this if you're listening to this podcast so that we can pass this along to our listeners as a plausible means of healing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have a question from Frank. Frank takes one capsule of MK7 daily to keep the calcium out of his arteries. His brother thinks he should take it, but he takes Plavix daily. So he's confused. Is MK7 going to thin the blood since it's derived from natto?
Hmm.
Or is it a clotter? Which is it?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And so, well, let's first of all look at the rationale for taking vitamin K. Well, let's talk about that, keeping, you have a handle on that,
yes.
So why don't you describe that.
Vitamin K has been so underrated, underestimated, everything. We need more vitamin K than was once thought, and it's not just that injection that they give to infants at birth, but vitamin K is critical to our bone health by keeping the calcium in our bones. But also vitamin K is crucial for keeping calcium from accumulating where it doesn't belong, such as in our coronary arteries, for example,
mm-hmm.
possibly in soft tissue like our breasts, which then may show up on a mammogram as a suspicious calcification.
Mm-hmm.
So vitamin K is really critical for all these things, cardiovascular disease, keeping the calcium where it belongs. Gee, maybe even for kidney stones, since we just finished talking about kidney stones, but also for our bone health. And
right.
So I know it's part of our osteoporosis arsenal.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. So,
Okay,
so the one thing about vitamin K and anticoagulation is that a commonly used anticoagulant medication, which is Coumadin or generically warfarin, is antagonized by vitamin K. That means that its blood thinning effects will be reversed by vitamin K. Okay, so that leads to a lot of confusion because that's the only circumstance in which taking vitamin K could lead to a blood clot. Because if you are not taking Coumadin or warfarin, then an ordinary person does not have an increased risk of a blood clot by taking vitamin K. And this is actually something that a lot of doctors don't understand. They worry when patients are taking other types of blood thinners like aspirin, or now they have a whole new, they have Plavix, or they have a whole new raft of other types of, different types of alternatives to Coumadin and warfarin, which are not antagonized by vitamin K. In other words, they by taking vitamin K, when you're taking those things, you're not going to put yourself at risk for a blood clot. Now, it's interesting that he mentions that the actual source of vitamin K is natto. Natto is a fermented Japanese food that is soy that is treated with a rhizopus mold to ferment it, and vitamin K is produced. But natto is also part of something called natto kinase, which actually acts not really like a blood thinner, but it's thrombolytic. It breaks up blood clots. So if you have, say, a DVT, or if you've had a blood clot in your leg, you might want to use natto kinase as a means of clearing that up or healing it. It's a clot buster, not so much a clot preventer. And so, really, I don't think that taking vitamin K on its own, unless you're taking Coumadin, is going to have much of an effect on your likelihood of bleeding one way or the other.
Mm. What about with Plavix, though?
With Plavix, there should not be a problem.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, like a lot of people are on the combination of aspirin and Plavix after a heart attack or after a stent to thin the blood.
Yep.
But vitamin K should not be a problem, although it's alarming because it's got guilt by association. It can make your blood more likely to clot if you're on Coumadin.
Right. So that's
and in fact,
to point out.
Precisely, vitamin K would be a useful thing to take because the vast majority of people who take Plavix are people with coronary disease or arteriosclerosis.
Yes.
So that's part of the arsenal of things, along with chiolic, which, you know, by the way, garlic can be a little bit of a blood thinner. Fish oil and fish oil can be a little bit of a blood thinner. But, you know, studies show that if you take fish oil with Coumadin, or if you take fish oil with Plavix, surprisingly, you might think, well, that's going to really make you your blood too thin. And doctors are scared of that combination. But actually, studies show that there are less incidences of pathological bleeding, like spontaneous bleeding, bleeding into the brain or bleeding into the eye, when people take fish oil along with these medications. So really, this is more of a theoretical concern. I can understand the concern because there's a little bit of blood thinning properties of fish oil, blood thinning properties of garlic, but really not too much to worry about in that, with those combinations.
Okay, Frank, thank you for this very, very good question. We hope this clears it up for you and your brother.
Right.
Okay. We have another question here from Donald. Dear Layla and Dr. H, have not heard you comment on the article citing levels of D above 40 can cause heart attack and pancreatic cancer.
Okay, well, let's keep our audience in suspense, okay, because there's some new concerns being raised about that vitamin D causes pancreatic cancer. I've seen the headlines, and they're rather lurid. And so, you know, just like an episode of, you know, Homeland or something, or, you know, like some of those serial radio serials of the 1940s, we'll tell you to listen to part two of today's podcast, where we'll continue with an answer to that question.
Okay.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla. And this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.